Good morning. We're on Yud Bet Amud Bet in the middle. Our aim for today is to get, I know it may seem imposing having two pages again, but we're going to get just down the middle of Yud Gimel Amud Aleph to the end of the Perek, and then next week we'll do Daf Yud Gimel in full, so that we can close out the second Perek in context with a little bit of perspective on what we've covered so far. Today, as I say, in the middle of Yud Bet Amud Bet, that first very small Mishnah, is the 10th Mishnah, and then on the bottom of that Amud, we've got the 11th and final Mishnah of the Perek. And across this second Perek, again, to give some framing so we can kind of land the plane of this Perek with everything in mind, has been discussing Ir Miklat, which we've said seems to appear at this moment because this Masechta is a reflection on political theory. How do we live together as society? How do we dispense justice? How do we keep the order? And this is all a setup so that we can talk about Malkus, which doesn't come until next week in the third Perek. The first Perek began speaking about Edom Zomamim, scheming witnesses, who get together and plot to have somebody else punished for something they didn't do and end up getting punished with exactly that punishment. And we said that's the closest justice ever comes to you get what you try to do, and we begin with cases where that doesn't work, where you try to accuse somebody of being Ben Chalutz or Ben Grusha, and we can't apply that to you, so you get Malkus instead. So it ties into the theme of the Perek, where Malkus is kind of a default punishment, but ironically it displays the impossibility of justice being dispensed. So the two themes of the first Perek were justice is always approximate. It's not always a 100% you did this and you're going to get the exact recompense. We do our best on earth, but real justice doesn't come until the next world. And the second thing was truth is always impossible to ascertain. You can have witnesses, you can have DNA, you can have CCTV, but we're never ever on earth going to fully access the truth. And that kind of came to a head right at the end of the Perek. We've got that famous debate between Rabbi Akiva and the sages about whether we would ever stop doing the death penalty. And Rabbi Akiva says, I could always find a way to get them off the death penalty. You ask some detailed question about fact, they wouldn't be able to answer and say, look, how can we put them to death if we don't know 100% that this happened? And the sages respond not by saying, no, I know a way you can find the fact. They say, yeah, you're right, you can't know the facts, but if we don't apply justice, murder will, everyone just go around killing and say, Rabbi Akiva will get me off. So we have to live in a society where truth is not 100% and justice is approximate, which led us into the second Perek, our Perek, which is, how should society function in a world where justice is approximate, where I can get charged, accused, indicted, imprisoned for something I didn't do, or executed for something? How do I live in a world like that? And we kind of meditated on what it means to be an attentive citizen. And that's what Ari Miklat is. It's about how are you intentional in the way that you live. The first five Mishnayos discussed the borders of intentionality. What are the things we do not expect you to be attentive towards as a good citizen, which includes when something's going down as opposed to up. When something's going up as opposed to down, which includes if you throw something and it was clear and then someone stuck their head out, we don't expect you to predict the future just to be consciousness about the present. If you're involved with doing a mitzvah, we don't expect you to be attentive to potential fallout. We had the controversial notion that it might be a mitzvah to apply corporal discipline to students and children, and said, look, we don't expect you to kind of hold back on what's good for society and what you're commanded to by God because you're worried about consequences. You've got to do what's right. And if something happens unintentionally or negligently, you're off the hook for that. Then we started paving out, once we went through the borders of intentionality, what does Ir Miklat look like? Where is it? What is provided in the city? Are you thrown into a deep, dark pit until the end of your sentence? And we started paving out what that looks like. You have to have a water supply. You can't have weapons on sale. We discussed last time, how does the sentence come to an end? We said that's with the death of the high priest, which got us down a rabbit hole of theology, because turns out if the high priest is how my sentence ends, I don't think I mentioned at the time, but you know, you can imagine if all federal prisoners went free every time a Supreme Court justice died, there'd be a lot of plots that have to stop to get rid of Supreme Court justices, and a huge amount of relief every time one died. And that's essentially what we say. When the high priest dies, everybody gets out of Ir Miklat. So the mothers of the high priest would go around kind of saying, you don't want him to die because I'm such a good mother and I'm going to provide for all of you, so you're not going to need anything. And then we said, do people's prayers work even if it's unjust? It was actually the high priest is responsible to some degree, because as a leader, you are endowed with power to shape the culture. And that means even to stop people being negligent. It doesn't just mean you're going to stop people doing horrific acts intentionally, because the truth is, if someone's bent on evil, giving a nice speech isn't always going to dissuade them. But if somebody's negligent, giving a speech about attentiveness may have an impact. Which leads us to these last two Mishnayot, some of which I'm still processing and open to feedback as we continue. So, middle of the page at Bet Amud Bet. Harag ba'oto ha'ir. Ba'ota ha'ir. If somebody is sent to exile because they killed negligently and just can't kick the habit, and in the middle of their sentence, they unintentionally, they keep throwing axes in the forest, and they just... But a friend of mine went on this on a date the other night, axe throwing. People been axe throwing? This is a new thing, right? This was not like 20 years ago people went, let's go axe throwing. 20 years ago, someone threw an axe, you ran. But now it's made a sport. So either way, he says, let's start axe throwing in your club. Said, the clientele here, I'm not sure, will be too good for that. But either way, somebody kills unintentionally. What would your instinct be? They've now committed a crime, negligent homicide. The punishment for negligent homicide, if found guilty, is you're sent into exile. They're in Gullus already. What would you suggest instinctively they should do? Go to a different Eremit club. Meaning the whole point of this is we're trying to make you feel uprooted, to make you more attentive. You should move to a different Eremit club. So, disagree? Complicated. And the Mishnah is going to suggest something else, unless you live in the Eremit club but not as a murderer. Why else might you live in an Eremit club if you're not an accidental murderer?
Levy.
Might be a Levy or... Population control, good house prices, rent control. You get a job, you work there, you're the water guy. Yeah, and we noted at some point when we were discussing Eremit club that the government's responsibility would be to ship population around to make sure Eremit club was populated. And it has to be 50% plus of non-murderers. It can't just be a city of accidental murderers. It can't be Chelm. It has to be a place where everybody is being shaped by good society. So if you kill in that city as an exile, Gola, you are exiled mishchuna l'shchuna. So imagine Queens is an Eremit club. You were living up in Buffalo. You killed accidentally, so you sent to Queens. Part of your, that's your city of refuge. Where do you live in Queens, of course? Yeah, where else? So you're in Jamaica States. That's the most desirable neighborhood in the Eremit club. And then accidentally, you kill somebody in Queens as you move around the city. So the Mishnah says, you have to go into exile, but you can't leave Queens. Once you've been sent into Eremit club, when are you allowed out? When the high priest dies. You can't go out before. We had a Mishnah said, even if you are the most expert general in the country and we're at war, you cannot leave. You are stuck. Why can't you leave? So ordinarily it's seen as, for your protection, you can't leave, because if you leave, you can get killed. What I think we might suggest here is that there's something extra. It's that part of the rehabilitation is that we want you to live more locally. We want to shrink your attention span to refine it. Meaning we allow them to kill you outside because we want you as an exilee to think of your world as Queens now. I don't want you to think about the Bronx or Brooklyn. I don't want you to think about what's going on in the world. You know, if I was thinking about how would you modern legislation for an Eremit club, you would insist no national papers, only local papers are available there because we want this Eremit club to be your new world. And if you go outside, it's like you've gone into the ether where you can't breathe and you might get killed. So you can't go out if you're a general, not because you might get killed, because that is not your world. There may be a war raging out there. But part of your sentence is you cannot think about the broader world because you need to learn what it's like to be an attentive person. And the best way to be an attentive person is to say, okay, you seem distracted. It's a big world and you're not paying attention. Just think about this room. Just focus on this room. And now what happens if you kill within that sphere, you can't be exiled to another city because your mind has been contracted. There is nothing outside this city. So what do? You have to go from Jamaica States to live in Hollis Hills or Holliswood or Forest. You've got to move within the new world that you're in to a new neighborhood. And on that basis, what would you imagine the consequence of being exiled to that neighborhood inside Queens would be? Where would you not allowed to be go? What would you not allowed? Where would you not allowed be allowed to go? Anywhere else from that neighborhood. right? Some people just think, oh, you just have to live in that neighborhood to feel uprooted, but you can still move around the city. But if you look at Tosfot, the very last line of Tosfot on the right, that's the right-hand column in the Rashi script, very last line, Im yigalel palcho, palcho kol to, if you are exiled within the city protects you, but shelo yetze mishchola nishchola, but you can't move from neighborhood to neighborhood. The neighborhood you are sent to is your new Dalet Amos. That's your new world. So you could imagine, to extrapolate, if you killed somebody accidentally within Forest Hills now, so now you're going to have to move from that street to another street, and you can never leave that street. And you can imagine eventually being, say, okay, you are not allowed to leave your apartment. Just focus on what's going on in there. Yeah.
Can people from the outside come visit you?
Yeah. Yeah, they may not want to. But I mean, there is a discussion, because it doesn't get addressed squarely by the Mishnah or the Gemara. If you're sent into exile, what happens to your family? It does not seem to be they have to go with you. So in theory, they could, but they don't have to. And there was a discussion in modern Israeli law about somebody was arrested and taken to jail. Should they be allowed to have family visits? Or should we oblige family to move if they're sent to somewhere? If somebody's exiled, there are questions that come up. But it seems to be they've got the choice. They don't have to. Okay. Ben Levi, Golem Me'ir Le'ir. If somebody lives in the city of refuge and they kill by mistake, but they're not sentenced there, so they go to another city. So they do feel exiled. Tana Rabbanan, how do we know that this, where does it all come from? So the Gemara quotes a brighter. Tana Rabbanan, the rabbis taught, God was speaking to Moshe, and he said to Moshe, you need to designate these cities. V'samti lecha makom, you need to set aside a city. And we have to look at the Aleph on the right-hand side, all the way at the border of the margin, the first pasuk. Ashelot sadav elokim anali ado, if you didn't plan this a death, and it came to your hand through God, v'samti lecha makom, you will set aside a place, v'sheyanusham, that you'll flee to. So the Gemara has now got a brighter that's going to run through what this pasuk means. God says to Moshe, you shall appoint a place, v'samti lecha, what does it mean, you shall appoint lecha for you? It means b'chayecha, during your lifetime, saying, Moshe, there will be a place of refuge while you are alive. What have we said about Moshe so far? There are going to be six cities. He designates three on the outside of Israel, so you'd assume they don't function until all six are done. That's what we've said. So what would happen if somebody killed by mistake in the Midbar? Somebody during the 40 years of wandering, just, well, we don't have an emiklat yet. Someone go kill him or put him under guard. So this is the Gemara saying there must have been a place of refuge during those years, during Moshe's lifetime. Makom, and where would it be? In the place, Mimkomecha, of your place. Now, what was Moshe's place? If you were to say, where's Moshe's designated area? Right, he was a Levi. I mean, in theory, you could have gone another route, but this is the route they take. Asher Yenusham, and that's where they flee. So Melamed Shayuzram Megalim B'Midbar. So we learn from here that B'chayecha, during Moshe's lifetime, the Jews had a place of refuge even in the desert. Lahechan Maglin, where would they go? Lamachane Levia, they would go to the Levite camp. Where was the Levite camp? If you think about the layout of the Jews in the desert. Yeah, it was in the middle. You had the Mishkan, the Levium, and then Israel on the outside. So you'd go further in. So there is a kind of sense that you are becoming more shrunk, diminished. Your scope is being limited if you're sent into the middle. Yeah, so the Tzaraas were sent out the camp in the other direction. And I guess that's an interesting analysis. Why would you send someone in as opposed to out? Right, and the aim for... What is the understanding of what we... Are we looking for an 830 minion? The understanding of... Good morning. The understanding of Tzaraas, what is the aim to send them into? Yeah, the point is isolation. That's what we're looking for the Metzora. In fact, that's where the word Levadad Yishkon, they should dwell alone. So you can imagine send them out, which is in contradistinction to the Gola, the exile. We're saying send in. We don't want you to be alone. We want you to be surrounded by people to learn how to live. So we send you essentially to the Education Institute where the teachers live, which is where the Levium are. Yeah. So Mikan Amru, this is where we learn Ben Levi Shaharag, that if a Levi kills, Golem Eplach Eplach, they move around from one Levite city to another, V'im Galal Palcho, Palcho Kalto. But if the Levi says, look, I've lived in Jamaica States all my life, this is my district, Queens is my Ir Miklat, I don't want to move. And now I killed, so I need to be in Ir Miklat, I get it, but why should I go to another city? So it says if they decide to stay in that Irmiklat, they can stay there and that's fine. So it seems to be that going to refuge doesn't necessarily have to entail leaving your home. Because the Levi can say, I'm not moving, I'm staying here, and it protects them. So it sounds like maybe as long as you kind of diminish your scope of interest, you can be in refuge. Amar Rav Acha bar Rav Ika Maikra, what is the verse for the, both the Mishnah and this Braita that says you can be exiled within the same city? How does that work? Ki be'umiklato yeshev, because it says in the verse, you shall dwell in the city of your refuge, ir shekal tato kfar. The city that's already provided you refuge. So it sounds like just because you've been provided refuge in a city doesn't disqualify it from continuing to give you refuge in the future. Again, displaying that notion that the whole point of this rehabilitative process is to make you more attentive. And the final kind of leg of making you more attentive is diminishing the scope of your attention. And then you can pay more attention. Okay, final Mishnah. Kayotzebo. And this could make for an awkward encounter. In the same spirit, the Mishnah begins, which some people delete because it's hard to connect this to the previous Mishnah. But in the same spirit, wrote, Ser shagala le'irmiklato. If somebody is exiled to their city of refuge, Faratsu anshei'ir l'chabdo, and the people of the city want to honor them, meaning somebody, I guess, l'havdel, Alex Baldwin is indicted for negligent homicide, and he's sent somewhere, and they want his autograph. You know, it's Alec Baldwin, you know, oh, could you do a skit for us? Or, you know, you're in Mission Impossible, you know, what's Tom Cruise, or whatever it is. They're giving him attention. Yomar, that exilee, has an obligation to say to them, Ratzeach ani, I am a murderer. Amrulev, and then they say to him, yeah, but can I still have an autograph? Afal pichein, even so, yikabal mehem, you can receive honor. So we had Rabbi Gottlieb speak last week about intentional crimes where people abuse power and how we deal with consequences of that. So here, obviously, we're talking about a very different case, unintentional murder, very high stakes. Somebody died, a family is now missing somebody because of the way you behaved. Are we permitted to still give you honor for the other parts of your legacy? And it seems to be, yes, but there should be consciousness that there has been consequences of inattention here. You have to say, I'm a murderer. And in draw, what's your uncle's name? Thank you. In Rav Zilberstein's book on Makot, he says a contemporary question came up. We don't have Irmiklat anymore. If somebody kills accidentally, negligently, and it doesn't get proven in Israeli court, but it happens, they don't get set into exile. Do they have an obligation every time they go to a shul and want to get an aliyah? Do they have to say, Rotzeach ani? They have to say, I'm a murderer. And does it still apply? Which would seem, again, like an awkward conversation, like I'm visiting for Shabbos. Do you want an aliyah? I'm a murderer. Oh, all right. Maybe you should go home. Yeah, or shishi then. Fine. Or fine, we'll give you maftir. So he debates this at length and kind of leaves it unanswered. But there are different views as to whether you'd have an obligation today to say this or not. So you have to say that, Shneema, how do I know you've got to say this? Zeh davar ha-rotzeach, because it says in the verse, this is the matter of the rotzeach, which sounds like you have to say something. Others suggest what it teaches is you only have to say it once, because it's in the singular. Zeh davar ha-rotzeach, you have to say, I'm a murderer. And if they insist on giving you honor, you don't have to say, no, I'm a murderer, you can take it. As we go on to the next page, continuing this Mishnah, how is this related to our subject? As we end this perek, that you have to say something like this, what would be the alternative? How could you imagine going to Irmiklat, them wanting to give you honor, and you not having to say anything?
Wear a badge.
Say again?
Wear a badge.
Oh, so you could have to, maybe you'd have to wear a badge. But let's say you don't need a badge, you don't need to say anything. What would that say about this process if you didn't have to address the fact that you were a murderer? It would indicate maybe that you didn't do anything wrong. That you're just being protected by potential revenge, but you don't deserve punishment. But it seems to be there. This is, again, we are not sending you to Irmiklat only to protect you from the vengeance of family. There is something problematic that has happened here. It's not problematic to the extent that it should stain you for the rest of your life, maybe. You say it once, but you do have to say it every time, once. So let's continue the Mishnah. Yud Gimel Amud Aleph at the top. And this is an interesting question that we haven't confronted yet, really. Ma'alin hayuscha le'levim, and if you get sent into exile, do you have to rent where you're living? Do you have to pay for it? I mean, I guess the question would be, if you're sent to jail, do you have to pay to rent for the jail cell? You should have to? Right. Right, everybody else pays for it. So actually, it turns out, if you look at Rashi on the top line on the right, he suggests maybe we're not talking about whether the murderer themselves has to pay, but whether society has to pay the Levium, meaning you're using part of the Levite city. They should get money for this. Rashi says, Ha'arim ha'schar le'levim sherotzim sochim ahem et bat ha'edira, which sounds like, in the plural, there is this big bucket of money that provides for these affairs. If the Rambam, that little aleph where it says ma'al in the first word, the Rambam talks about it in the singular, that the murderer themselves has to pay, which you could imagine would compound the attentiveness we expect from people. Because if you know you get sent into exile and you don't have a huge amount of funds, you don't have a mortgage, you inherited a family estate, if you have to start renting an apartment in the middle of a metropolis, you can't afford that. So you're going to have to be, or you're going to debt, I guess you're going to have to be very much on top of what you're doing so you don't end up in this position. That's the word of Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Meir says, Lo ha-yumalin slan tzchar. You don't have to pay levim. This is free accommodation while you are in your miklat, which again sounds like for Rabbi Meir, you're being sent here for your protection. We're not going to make you pay. Like if you put in witness protection program by the government, they don't make you, do they make you pay rent? I assume not. I assume the government says, we're putting you in protection because we owe you this because you helped our case or you're in danger. So we're going to send you out to Colorado and we're not going to make you pay your mortgage. I don't know. All right. If anybody finds out, well, no. So that was the first argument. I have a second argument in the Mishpat Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda, which seems to be along similar lines. Again, Rabbi Yehuda says, if you're in your miklat, you have to pay for where you're living. Rabbi Meir says you don't. It's government provided or it's just free. Second debate. V'choze l'srara shahaya ba. Reb Meir says, not only do you not have to pay rent while you're in the Yer Miklat, once your time is up, once the high priest dies and you go free, you can go back to your position. If you were mayor of the town, you become mayor again, which you could imagine. Again, the current laws or the current practices of the Justice Department, as far as we know, is you don't indict a sitting president. I have to imagine that if a president committed murder in public, the Justice Department would be under quite a lot of pressure to indict them. The Senate would be empowered to impeach. And the question would be, politically, whether they would do that or not. And you'd have to imagine that if a president visibly murdered somebody on camera, even their own party in power would say, I guess we should impeach. I mean, this is what happened with Nixon. His own party said, this is untenable, we're going to impeach you, you should resign. But contemporary politics has shifted, so everything's very partisan. So, correct. But the Justice Department says we won't indict if anybody's in office. So the only way we're ever going to indict is if they're out. So if the Senate impeaches and convicts, then we'll indict. But as it stands, if a president committed murder, the Justice Department would not charge and indict them as long as they're in office, is how the Justice Department behaves right now. But if you imagine that they would indict them, that's not in the Constitution, that's just Justice Department ethics. You could imagine them saying, Senate's not going to impeach, this is intolerable, we have to, they committed murder on camera. So you could imagine them convicting them, putting them in jail. They can't function as president anymore because they're in jail, so I guess they signed the 25th Amendment. They refuse to resign, so the vice president takes powers because the cabinet says the 25th Amendment. So what happens when they go free? Say, okay, 25th Amendment now lapses because now I can function in office again. And I'm back. That was a question that hasn't been resolved yet. We were all waiting to see whether that question would get tested. But it was not tested in the end. But it's an interesting question. So then the question would be, the truth is, even if you're in Israel, but even if you are pardoned, part of the condition of a pardon is the admittance of guilt. So you'd go free, but so the question would be, you're still now declared a guilty person with a verdict of murder or whatever it is. I don't think he stood up and said, I'm guilty, but part of the pardon is within the script of it, you admit that you've committed the crime to be pardoned of. Otherwise, it would be an kind of illogical act. People who get pardoned may protest their innocence, but within the script of the pardon is an admission of guilt, just logically.
When they say I'm a murderer, do they say I need to rat somebody or I need rotzeach?
Rotzeach ani is the way it's formed, which
even
is...
Even though rotzeach means to murder someone illegally, and to kill somebody means you don't know. Besdin has the right. I mean, when the Goyim translate lo kirtzach, they don't translate you shall murder, they translate you shall kill.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting point. And we could get kind of homiletic and suggest that we want this person to see themselves as a murderer and not to like find exculpatory, like, it wasn't really me, somebody died while I was in the room, but you have to say I'm a murderer. And maybe it's interesting, you have to start reframing yourself as I did something horrific. It was negligent, unintelligent, but somebody died and I'm the murderer. But you're right, it does. It's an odd, because that is very different to saying I'm a murderer than I killed somebody by mistake. So that's interesting. I maybe explore what the commentators say. It's interesting. So Reb Meir says, you go back to your place of honor. So in our kind of loopy example, if a president was arrested, indicted, put in jail, and then came out, they could continue serving as president. You go back to where you were. So if you were put, and this would obviously be a case of negligent homicide, so I guess the case would be not a president murdered somebody, but let's say the president was on a set, pulled the trigger, and somebody died, and it was the same case of Alec Baldwin when they're president. They go to jail for negligent homicide. Now can they serve in office again? Reb Meir says, yes. The only reason you're sent away is for your protection, it seems. Reb Yehuda Omer, lo hayachos l'esrosh shahaya, but Reb Yehuda says, no, you cannot go back. Now, is there a possible way you could say it's also for your protection that you can't go back? Yeah, it could be like, if you go back to being president, you're going to be in the face of the family every single day, and it's going to kind of arouse their vengeance, but if you just sit quietly, it won't. But it seems to be, he's saying, there's something permanent on your record now. So, that's the Mishnah. We had 3 points. Number one, if you go to your mikvah, you have to say Rotzeach Ani once. Number two, there's debate about whether you have to pay rent. Between Rabbi and Reb Meir. And number three, there's debate about whether you can go back to where you were, or has this affected you for the rest of your life. Rav Kahana. Rav Kahana says, talking about, they skip the Rotzeach Ani question, that seems to be settled. What about the debate about rent? Rav Kahana says, Machloket Beshesh, the whole debate is only with the six central cities of refuge that were designated by Hashem through Moshe originally. The Marsavar, the one view is, Lachem Leklita, when it says these cities are for you, Imiklat Lachem, they're for you, meaning they're for your refuge. But that's it. And you have to pay for it, but we'll protect you. Marsavar, the other view is, Lachem, what does it mean it's for you? Lachol Sarcheim, it's for all your needs. That's a debate. Aval Ba'arbim Ushtaim, but with the other 42 Levite cities, everyone agrees you got to pay rent. So the default is, of course you've got to pay rent, but there seems to be some cut-out exception in the case of the six major cities. God says, you don't have to pay rent, according to one view. So there is a minority view, in the minority of cases, you are free not to pay rent in these cities. Amalei Rava, Rava responds, says, Havadai lechem, in the six cities, there's no disagreement. L'chol sarcheichem mashma, everybody agrees, you do not pay rent in these six cities. And I find this distinction hard, that there should be six cities of refuge where you don't pay rent, and then a view that in the rest of them you do, meaning if I then killed by mistake, where would I go?
Rent-free.
Yeah, I'd find the six cities. So, I mean, it seems to be you're setting up a system where everybody is going to be running to these free places, and the other 42 cities, you know, why would I end up there unless it...
Maybe those six cities are not desirable.
Right, so it could be, because everybody's running there, you know, this is the infested place where everybody, the most negligent people run, who also are the cheapest people. Maybe you want to go to a more rural area where you've got to pay rent, but you're more likely to last. So, interesting. Maybe it is forcing you to make a decision about where you want to live and how you want to live, which already makes you more attentive. Interesting. So Rava says, Alma Rava, Machloket Barba Mishtaim. The whole debate is only with the 42. Everybody agrees the 6 is rent-free. But the 42, that's the debate. Marsava, one view is Va'alehim Titnu, when it says, and on these you are given extra cities. Kihanach Liklita. It means on these, in addition to these, you get places of refuge. But that's it. You don't get free rent. Marsava Alehim Titnu, and the other view that says, on these you are given. In addition, Kihanach, just like the other ones. Mahanach Lekol Sarchechem, Afaninam Lekol Sarchechem. These as well are provided for you, and this is a view of Reb Meir that you don't have to pay anywhere. Aval sheish divra kol ha'yumalim slem tchar, but in the 6, everybody agrees it is rent free. Which means in these 6 cities, you're being given government provisions and you're kept here on your own, which is, I guess, that's a very helpful way to resolve the tension in my mind. Last 10 lines. Chazalas Rav Shahayaba. And we're going to finish with a comparison between two situations, which is the gola, the person who's sent into exile, and if somebody owes money to somebody and can't pay them back, what is the consequence? You go and you become a Eved Ivri. You become their slave. And if you become an Eved Ivri, how long are you an Eved Ivri for?
6 years. It depends when the Shemitah.
Right, so Shemitah ends everything. But the default is 6 years. Yovel ends everything, but the default is 6 years. So what happens if you do that, and then you come out, and you were the mayor, but you couldn't afford... I mean, I don't want to use horrible, non-exact examples, but there could be somebody who's a very prominent person who don't have the money to pay for something. Lahavdel Alex Jones, who's the InfoWars guy, has now been given a verdict that he owes something like $3 billion. And he's got a lot of money. He's a prominent person, but he can't afford that. So in theory, under Jewish law, if you have to pay this amount of money and you can't afford it, you've got to become an Eved Ivri or an Eved Americani or whatever you want to call it until you pay it off. So what happens when you come out? Can you return to your position of prominence? Meaning the only, if I would have had the money, I would have just paid them and that would have been it and I could have carried on. I had to become an Eved because I didn't have the money, so can I return to my place or not? That's a debate that is equally held by Reb Yehuda and Reb Meir. So Tana Rabbana, the rabbis taught, in the context of an Eved Ivri, the Shaval Mishpachto, and after their service, they'll return to their family, Velachuzat Avotav, and to the holdings of their ancestors, meaning to their land. Yashuv, they'll return. The Mishpachto Hu Shav, and the fact that it says you return to your family, says the Braita, means that you return home to your family, but you don't return to places of honor. You return to your land, you return to your family, but you don't get to hold office again. Divrei Rabbi Yehuda, that's Rabbi Yehuda's view. Reb Meir says, no, you go back to the position they held. It says to the land of your fathers, and it doesn't just mean the holdings, but it means the positions too, just like them. So you would take back your position. It's basically a financial arrangement. The reason you become an Eved Ivri does not affect your status. It's not because... meaning, is there any way... Let's say you owe somebody money, you can't pay them back, so you have to go into Avdut. Is there any way to see that other than a financial transaction that you have to pay them, so this is a way to do it? Is there a way to see you as culpable in this a form of punishment? What are you culpable of?
Either living beyond your means, or in this case, his case is a lot worse. He did something that caused judgment against him for a large sum of money. That was clearly something bad that he did. The other way, you could just extend yourself beyond your means, which is
right.
Objectively bad, but a bad way to focus your life.
Yeah, so I'd say in the case of crimes where you're sent into Avdut because you owe money because you stole or because you did harm, I could see you being culpable, you're under Avdut, because you owe them something more than just money. But even in the minimal case, you may have to go, you did nothing wrong. I borrowed money, I can't pay them back, I don't know what to do, I owe it right now. You have to go into Avdut, what's the crime? You didn't, financial planning, financial mismanagement. It's not a crime in the sense, like it says in the Torah, you shall not financially mismanage. But if you owe somebody money, you can't pay them back, there is culpability. In the way, sometimes it may not be entirely your fault. We all know financial markets don't always follow rational rules, but there seems to be some level of culpability. If you owe somebody money, you have to be hyper-conscious every moment that you're in their debt and that I've got obligations. And if you can't meet them, what does Avdut do? It's not just that I'm going to pay you back the equivalent, but I'm literally in your service. I'm reminded every waking moment that I have obligations to other people. I guess for a mayor, that's not how we view it. It's just a transactional arrangement. You need to pay back money. Once you're out, you're back in office, wherever you were. Rabbi Yehuda says, no, there is a transformative experience of being an avdut. You're in somebody's servants. You are kind of surrounded by obligations to other people as their inferiors to some level. And the Brayta continues, V'chein begola, this is the fifth line up, first word in the line is Tavotah, V'chein begola, and so too with an exilee, Reb Meir and Reb Yehuda have a disagreement. Kishu Omer, when it says Yashuv, the gola will return from Ir Miklat afterwards, L'rabot et haratzeach, that includes the case of the exilee, from this case of the Eved Ivri, there's a comparison. My v'chein begola, what does it mean, and so too with an exilee, the Brayta says, G'detanya, we've got another Brayta, Yashuv haratzeach eretzachutzato, the murderer, and this is, I guess, to the point Josh raised before, he's called a rotzeach by the pasuk, meaning it says, haratzeach, the murderer who killed by negligent means, goes back to the land of their holding, which I think is interesting, because I guess it makes a point. Afterwards, they are the pasuk calls them rotzeach. They're not called a rotzeach in the lead-up. It was an accident, or it was negligent. And here, we're saying, you are a murderer, whether you did it intentionally or not. They go back to the land of their holding. Rabbi Yehuda says, you don't go back to the position that you held. Part of this rehabilitation, it is not designed to kind of clean your slate. It is designed to change you and make you a more attentive person. And because you are changed, you can't go back to the office you were in, presumably. You can return to the office in which you held. Gamar Shiva, Shiva Mehatam. And they both learn it from the case of Eved Ivri. So we finish this perek reflecting that if you're sent into exile, the experience of exile should be seen, however you view this process, through the prism of servitude. In the same way that Eved Ivri is sent into that program, you're sent into this program, however you want to weigh that up. So that was the second perek. We've now got a sense of how attentive we need to be as citizens, how we may rehabilitate attentiveness over time. This is not in practice, of course, today, in Miklat, but there, throughout the medieval period, I should say, there were practices to exile people within the Jewish community. If somebody misbehaved, they would send them into exile and say, okay, 2 years, 3 years, they would give kind of approximate, and it wouldn't be to Ir Miklat to say you have to leave the country and go to a different city. And of course, there were controversies of not telling the people they were going, we're exiling them because just a new guy shows up, which is why maybe there's an obligation to say Ratzeach Ani, like that's the reason I'm here. Okay.
Not from Israel, but...
Say again?
Like they would exile them from Israel, or just...
I don't know, actually. There are records within Europe of people having been sent, like from Frankfurt, you have to go and live in Mainz for 2 years. And then the question will come up, well, what about my family? Does your family have to go? And this is something Rabbi Gottlieb mentioned last week, which is there are victims to misdemeanors on all levels. There are victims immediately, and spouse, children, they all have to suffer, and that's part of responsibility. And the truth is, even without exile, if somebody's sent to jail, they don't have a parent anymore. If the parent does something wrong and they're stuck in jail. So it's a complicated matter, but this is kind of testing the waters of theoretically how do we treat unintentional punishment. Now, the first two prakim, we have dealt with the concepts of truth, justice, approximation, impossibility, attentiveness, rehabilitation. Is it possible to ever fully redeem inattentiveness? And that's how we finish with, it's unclear. For some, once you've been through this process, you can go back to where you were. And for some, either you've done too much damage, or we presume you can't really rehabilitate inattentiveness fully. What we'll do next week, we'll turn to the new perek, which is about Malkus. And I guess we'll give a more of an introduction then, and then we'll do Yud Gimel next week. It's going to be quite a dense beginning with a lot of prohibitions and what you get whipped for. Out of interest, if you were to designate a beautiful way to end, if you were to think about what kind of crimes can you get punished for in American law generally? What crimes do you get punished for in American law? Well, it's interesting because we assume, well, everything, but there's actually a whole segment of human life that there are no punishments or consequences for an American life.
Sorry.
It's okay.
Is that my fault?
No, somebody else was calling. Well, religious life. There are zero punishments if I curse God. There are zero punishments if I eat something that offends somebody's sensibilities. I only get punished in the United States, essentially, for civil crimes, crimes between other people, or crimes to the state. But anything to do with non-interpersonal relationships, you don't get punished. I only get punished if there's potential harm involved. In Jewish law, we're not going to discuss any of those cases in the next parak, because in Jewish law, what happens if I hurt somebody else? It's all damages. It's all monetary exchange. What we're going to talk about is malchus. The only time you get malchus in Jewish law is for religious crimes, when I do something against God. So we're going to have to debate, what is the purpose of malchus then? If it's not about recompense to somebody you've harmed, God can't get harmed, presumably. So what is malchus about? Which case does it appear? Can you do one thing wrong and get 14 sets of lashes for it? And we'll see the different cases that appear, what is considered a religious law and what isn't. I mean, the truth is there were some punishments on the books still relatively recently, which do not involve harm to another person, but were punished through a religious legacy. I don't know which case I'm thinking about. It's not on the books in the United States anymore. It came off the books in England in 1971, stopped officially being a crime. It's still, it's a homosexuality. Until 1971, you could be jailed for homosexuality between two consensual people. Meaning two people consensually have a relationship and the government said, we're going to put you in jail. Which to the modern sense is like, they didn't hurt anybody. I don't understand. Because through the contemporary lens, you only get punished if there's harm involved. In Jewish law, at least as conceived, as we'll see in this following perek, you get punished for all sorts of things where there's no harm to other people. And in fact, the punishment is not give us some tact, it's you are going to get hit. There's going to be physical responses. So we'll have to discuss some of this as we go forward. And of course, the Mishnah, the Perek will end, as we noted last time, with the famous discussion between Rabbi Akiva and the sages, where Rabbi Akiva walks through the ruins of the temple laughing, which will have to kind of loom over the discussion of what this punishment is about and what kind of religious responsibilities toward God and society are. We'll get to that next week. In the meantime, enjoy 903. Have a wonderful day. I think you can probably grab another bagel. There's a QJCC breakfast upstairs, I think. Enjoy. Oh, we got benching?